This is a CBC podcast.
Hello and welcome to a special holiday edition of Power and Politics. I'm David Cochrane in Ottawa. In 2 weeks, the federal government lays out its spending roadmap for the year ahead. With affordability still a major challenge for households, what should Canadians expect? That's what we're focused on this hour. The Liberal government heads into this budget under pressure to rein in spending. Canada's deficit is projected to be $38.4 billion this year, and as long as there's a deficit, the debt will only get bigger. It's nearly doubled since 2015 to $1.2 trillion, costing the government tens of billions of dollars in interest alone every year. But Canadians are feeling the squeeze too. Interest rates are at a 23-year high. And yes, that's helped bring down overall inflation, but it's also sent the cost of rent and mortgages through the roof. Meanwhile, the economy is currently starved for growth. GDP barely grew in the fourth quarter of last year after a small contraction in the previous quarter. Goldie Hyder is the president and CEO of the Business Council of Canada, and he joins me now. Goldie, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you.
When it comes to the federal government reining in the spending of the budget, this has been a consistent call from you and your organization. What does that look like on April 16th to make you happy?
Yeah, well, look, why ask me? Let's look at what the government said itself. What the government said itself in the last budget is, we are going to have this new guardrail. They seem to have moving ones, but let's just say this is the one they're going to stick to. We're going to reduce current costs, which are 1.4% of our GDP, down to 1% starting in the year 2026. Where is that 0.4 going to come from? It represents about roughly $12 billion a year over the course of the next 4 to 5 years. So the question of the government is, where are you going to find the $48 to $50 billion that's necessary to get you there? And the answer from them has been effectively one announcement by our Treasury Board minister saying, who wrote to their own colleagues to say, I need to find $15 billion in savings,
right. Which
within 48 hours became repurposing. I mean, Canadians are smart enough to know the difference between savings and repurposing. And so we have a government here that just doesn't seem to understand that you can't spend willy-nilly. You have to have a plan. You have to execute it. And the flip side of that, David, is to grow the economy. Grow your revenues.
Right. The repurposing, though, it wasn't one for one, right? It wasn't for every dollar that came out of one program. It went into another program. There was some savings
minuscule.
I believe. But
look, our view is just tell Canadians where are you going to find this 0.4% of GDP that you need to reduce between now and then. I think it's a legitimate question. They need to know because it's possible it's going to come at their expense. And this is why we're saying find growth-enabling policies. Don't just spend all your time thinking about redistribution. I mean, the Prime Minister himself has said the economy is not about numbers. It's about people. Let me assure you, it's about numbers. And those numbers affect people. And that's what we're trying to do is actually create the conditions for collaboration, partnership with the government of any political stripe. It doesn't matter to us. Let's find a way to grow our economy and not cut our way there either.
But when you talk about growth, what's a growth-enabling policy you want to see from Chrystia Freeland on the 16th? Because they've been pouring a lot of money into green transition through the EV plant investments and through the tax credits to encourage investment along those lines. What are you looking for?
They've been pouring a lot into their announcements of these policies. I think this government has, first of all, the fiscal thing does matter, David. Businesses do look at if a government's not serious about its fiscal framework, what it sees is taxes, not just taxes on corporations, but taxes on employees. So as competitive as we are for capital, we're also competitive for talent. And so people need to see a government that's serious about fiscal reform. But in addition to that, again, the thing I wrote to the Prime Minister about is his own announcements, their own policies on the permitting reform. If you create the conditions for capital to form in here, not latent with incentives for foreign companies, but for Canadian companies, for domestic companies. There's debates about what our pension plans should do. You know what everybody should be focused on? Create the investment climate for capital to form here from anywhere in the world, but also from Canadian companies, which means you need predictable, stable permitting reform, something the government promised by December 31st of 2023, still waiting. And then last one I would just note is the reaction from the government, which we celebrated and acknowledged as robust, the response to the so-called IRA in the U.S., setting aside whether we need it or didn't need it, Canada had to respond. The rest of the world is responding. Very robust programs were announced and announced in 2023 budget. It's nearly 2024 budget, and we're being told by the end of this year now, we'll hopefully get to a place where your members and others will see what is available. It's too long. It's too slow. We have to act with greater urgency and ambition because the Americans are handing out checks right now.
You talk about like investment, though. And I mean, we hear this from the Deputy Prime Minister and the Finance Minister, Chrystia Freeland, that Canada ranks really high in terms of direct foreign investment. There is money, they argue, flowing into Canada from outside of Canada. Why do you think there's a chill on it domestically?
Maybe those who are here know a little bit more than those who are finding out the other end. I mean, take a look at Nordstrom, Target, Rexall. Companies have come, companies have gone. It's a difficult place. And you're seeing now the reputation that this is not a place that builds things anymore. And that's very important for our country. Look, we agree, this is Canada's moment. You know, they're talking about seizing the moment. But that hashtag and rhetoric has to be put in place with the policies that support that. So markets look, capital looks and says, well, what are you doing here? Are you like screaming out against profits? When did profits become a bad word in a democracy that is free enterprise and celebrates capital? Those profits were made after jobs were created, after taxes were paid, after philanthropy was done, after CSR was done, innovation was done. And who are those profits for? They're for Canadians. There are Canadian pension plans, Canadian RSPs, Canadian shareholders, Canadian TFSAs. We shouldn't be creating a condition that says we're just going to create an attack on business. And by the way, from both sides. This is what I'm concerned by is in a pre sort of writ environment that we seem to be in. Sure. For the next 18 months, what's populist and what's great politics is going to make for horrible public policy. But you know what? Capital just moves. Talent doesn't come. And I don't want to be, believe me, in this chair telling you I told you so. And this is what my members are really trying to create is a mechanism by which we can work together to grow the pie, not just spend all our efforts on attacking business.
But there are certain sectors of the economy that have done very well while Canadians have done not so well.
Well, I'm not sure Canadians have not done well. I think Canadians aren't feeling the benefits of the economic.
Well, cost of living is really high. You know, mortgage rates are really high.
Wages
all of these
are
things are happening. But not in some sectors, for example. Like, you know, and I don't want to pick on a particular company, but like the grocery stores are the one that's most often targeted for the windfall profits that you're warning against. We saw in the pandemic, you know, early they gave a $2 an hour hero pay, as they called it, bump to people, and quickly got rid of that before things were over. And the profits and the revenues just keep growing and growing and growing while the grocery bills keep growing and the employees are not.
You're in an industry where the margins are in the 5% range. You're in an industry where there is a lot of competition. Not only is there competition from Canadians and four or five different chains there, you've got three of the bigger multinationals here with Amazon and Costco and Walmart. So you've got a lot of competition. It's possible the other issues could well be supply, demand, supply chains, that this is not about profits as much as it is about the reality of that industry right now. So I think we have to get the facts out there. And I know that that's one of the things that you're trying to do. And I appreciate that.
Yeah, look, I appreciate that the price of food is tied to a lot of global factors that have very little to do with things like carbon pricing and all these sorts of things domestically because it is a global phenomenon. But there are still companies that are churning up big profits while reducing the size of their workforce and while costs are going up for Canadians. So, like, I know you're warning against the negative impact of this on the business sector and the knock-on effect for retirements and savings. But we are in this pre-writ period, and this is the mood.
Well,
right?
GDP,
and it's not just the Liberals. It's all the parties talking
about
this.
GDP per capita has declined for six consecutive quarters here. You listen to the United States talk about introducing corporate taxes, as the president has suggested. What a great opportunity for Canada to differentiate itself. It's hard enough to compete with the Americans as it is. Why not work with the business community to figure out how it is we can grow our economy? Because it's through that growth that we're going to be able to sustain the programs, help those who are not able to help themselves, you know, take care of our social programs, which Canadians know. I mean, they're in some cases literally on life support. Our healthcare system needs a lot of reform. How are we going to do that if only thing we're going to do is move the shells around and just simply take on business? Why not collaborate? Why not cooperate? And inflation, David, and something else that's the reasons, the real cause behind a lot of this is it's still sticky. And the worst thing you can do as a finance minister today is to add to that with more spending. And so one of the reasons we're calling for no new spending is you haven't even done a good job with the ones you've already announced.
Well, most of the spending inflation from the government sector now is provincial and municipal. This is what the analysis shows. It's less the federal stuff because they've unwound a lot of the
things. They've given a lot to both those governments. But spend wisely. No one is saying don't spend. No one is saying, you know, don't invest in people. And businesses invest in people all the time, particularly in training, in skills. Skills, preparing for the new jobs. Some of those losses that you spoke about are not jobs that were going to be replaced. So what you've really done is reallocated some of that capital to say, okay, how are we going to invest in the productivity of our country and in our businesses? And all of that trickles down. That's the plan. That's the hope. You know, the members I work for, I can certainly say, are driven by making Canada competitive, by creating an environment in which Canadians can prosper as much as businesses can prosper. And there's nothing wrong with either one of those two things.
One of the big challenges they're facing in terms of meeting the climate goals of this government and also sustaining a robust economy is how to deal with the oil and gas sector in Canada. Your organization is pushing them to reconsider their oil and gas emissions cap. They've already gotten significant pushback on this at the provincial government level, Alberta and Saskatchewan and Newfoundland and Labrador. How do they proceed on this? Oil companies are still making pretty good money. How do you proceed on this and hit your emissions targets to save the planet, as everyone says, if the oil and gas sector is not forced to hit some sort of a target?
Well, here's what I know about emissions. Much like COVID and capital, they don't respect any borders or boundaries. And so if we're serious, if we're going to have an adult conversation about how to reduce emissions, we have to do it from a global perspective, not a local perspective. Canada has the capacity to help countries like Japan, Korea, India, China, and others who are building up coal plants to offload that onto liquefied natural gas, LNG, which, you know, next year the LNG Canada project will come online and there's a permitting done for phase two. But if we get more gas there, we could get it out. Nuclear is going to be a big part of this, something the government was originally opposed to, but they had to come around because you know what's happening, David? The facts can never be ignored. They just keep coming back. And now the government sees that. Same thing originally on carbon capture. Didn't want to capture it, now recognizes that we need to do it. We can do these things. But I got to tell you, if we come at an emissions cap, if I were the Department of Finance, I would be extremely concerned. Now, we have a government that seems to have a little less worry about the fiscal framework, no more than happy to run deficit and debt, is now going to go after an industry that represents about 10% of our GDP. The consequences of that on revenues will be even higher. And we're just creating a perfect storm if we're not careful.
But you say we have that globally. You talked about the economic performance of GDP per capita declining. Yeah. Our emissions per capita are high, you know, compared to the rest of the world. I mean, I know in the overall picture, it's a small percentage of the global picture, but on a per capita global basis, I mean, don't we need to take care of our own business here at home if we're going to be credible in speaking to the rest of the world?
The choices are very limited for people who want oil and gas. And of all of the choices that they have, Canada is the cleanest. Canada is the one most committed to the environment. Canada is the one that's most committed to the innovation. And so we can be a part of the solution. Our government should be pushing the fight for Article 6. Right, the idea that maybe Canada's emissions have to go up, but the global emissions come down. So if you're serious about climate change, that should be the objective, not penalizing an industry here that's trying to help offset the increase in emissions that's taking place around the world.
Okay. Goldie Hyder, President and CEO of the Business Council of Canada. We'll check back with you on Budget Day.
Always good to be with you, David.
The Liberal government is facing multiple social challenges as it debates what to include in this month's federal budget. There's an ongoing climate crisis, there is a severe housing shortage, and healthcare is under significant pressure. So, how do they prioritize their spending? Armin Yalnizian is the Atkinson Fellow on the Future of Workers at the Atkinson Foundation, and she joins me now. Armin, it's always good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So in the run-up to this budget, we've heard a lot of concerns raised about the need to invest in productivity because Canada's GDP per capita is declining compared to countries such as the United States. You don't think that's the right metric to focus on. What's the issue there?
The issue is that it doesn't tell us anything about why GDP per capita is higher in the United States. And it is higher in the United States for a few reasons. First of all, it has definitely increased its oil production and it has increased its nature as a tax haven. And that's what the U.S. has in common with almost all of the big countries that, you know, top the list in terms of GDP per capita, which are oil exporters and tax havens. But the other thing that puts the United States apart from everybody else is soaring inequality. And that also can drive up GDP per capita, which is an average measure that tells you nothing about its distribution or where that money goes once you have generated it in an economy. So it's not the right metric to be, you know, it's not our lodestar metric. There's lots of different ways of focusing on how you improve the productivity of a nation. And frankly, there's a clue in a handful of the nations that are at the top of the heap, which are the Nordic nations that have used their money to invest in people broadly and let them do what they do best, which is generate jobs, generate wealth, generate innovations. You can't do that if you're hungry, if you're looking for a place to live or worried about losing your place. You can't do that if it costs too much to educate yourself. And that's the way they have spent their money in terms of GDP per capita. It's a great lesson for us to pay attention to. Put the capita back into GDP per capita.
Right. You can drive your GDP per capita by creating a bunch of billionaires, but that does nothing for middle class and working class people because they don't necessarily share in that. So you mentioned the Nordic countries. Is that where Canada should look as it's preparing for this budget on what its priorities should be? I know when we spoke at the cabinet retreat in Montreal, you advised the government to invest in the care economy, to focus on, you know, long-term care, care at home, home care, all of these things as a way of allowing for economic productivity and societal growth. Where do you think they need to go?
Well, I absolutely think that that is one of the core jobs of government. And it's all of government. It isn't just the federal government, but it's definitely not an area that you want to back off from. What's fascinating to me is just in the last few days, we've heard the federal government basically saying to the provinces, to whom they gave billions upon billions of dollars, if you don't use it for the reason we gave our federal taxpayers' money to you to improve things like healthcare, long-term care, childcare, if you don't use it for those reasons, we're going to take it back from you and we're going to take our turn in spending it in the places that people want it spent. So I think we're looking at a very muscular approach to, yeah, you've got the money. How are you using it? And what are you getting for it? What is your value for what you are spending? And I think that's exactly the appropriate way to look forward at how are you actually boosting the entire economy for everybody as we move forward.
When you look at these competing demands and you overlay it with the political situation and the runway the government has until the next election, and then you factor in that despite the promises to make progress on housing and other things, the government has committed to keeping the deficit at $40 billion or below, how much room do you reasonably expect Chrystia Freeland to have to deliver on meaningful measures in this budget?
Yeah, that's a great question, David. And of course, just a reminder to everybody that fiscal anchors are really important, but governments are more than bean counters. And there's lots of ways to deal with both the revenue as well as the expenditure side. Don't forget, we put in $10 billion in infrastructure projects and actually levered another $10 billion from the private sector. And those projects are beginning to have returns on investment. We could recycle that source of revenue. We could also be looking at things like the people that left all the way to the bank during the pandemic did really, really well, taking a look at how both corporations and people that did really well can contribute to the people that paid the highest price for the pandemic and the pandemic reopening. So there are different ways of looking at the revenue side of it, other than just, you know, axing the tax, cutting the programs. And that's really what's on offer right now. As we go forward to this next budget, it's showtime, right? Like the next budget is too late. This is the moment that the calendar says, don't just tell us, show us what you can do as a government and give us a reason to vote for you again. If you're going to give us that reason, this is your chance to do it.
Well, there is, though, a push to rein in spending that is time to normalize, you know, the ledger after the big spending necessities of the pandemic. And you do have the New Democrats saying, hey, let's look at a windfall tax for some of these people you say made out all the way to the bank during the pandemic. But business groups and others pushing back against that idea. Do you think that's reasonably a path Chrystia Freeland and Justin Trudeau could embark on, given the dynamic in the country right now?
I think if they cut spending, I mean, there's always places you can cut spending. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of ways of reallocating funding within the envelope. But to cut spending as a share of the economy goes exactly counter what demographic trends require, which is a growing population that is no longer in the workforce. It's retired. It needs more health care. It needs more long-term care. It needs more stuff that only taxes can pay for. So if you're going to cut taxes and cut spending, you're moving in the opposite direction to what governance now requires. It is totally a shift from the last 40 years, which has been all about less government, more market. But that is not the moment we are in and won't be for about 20 years. And, you know, we have to come to grips with that. Of course, business doesn't want that to happen. Business doesn't want to be taxed. And it doesn't want governments to spend. But if we rely on the private sector to spend on the care economy in particular, what we're seeing in the United States, the United Kingdom, and Europe is that we are paying more, getting less, and at a time when we're going to need more. Why would we go down that path? It's crazy.
So just as a final point, you know, compared to where we were leading into last year's budget, there's more clarity and it's a better picture, not just a clearer picture. The country seems to have avoided the recession and hit what appears to be the soft landing that a lot of people didn't think would happen. But even though inflation has slowed down, There's still affordability challenges because of the baked-in increases in those costs. Young people in particular are angry and looking for help and want to see something on the affordability side. What can the government do in this budget for the under 40, under 35, under 30 crowd in particular?
100% it's got to be on rental housing. And that isn't just the under 40s. It includes people that are having to leave their households because mortgage costs have eclipsed it. So the rental market, and in particularly the non-market part of rental housing, is absolutely vital. But they could also be doing things like, as they've been doing for the under 40 set, is improving childcare, improving access to dental care, vision care, pharmacare, the things that you pay for out of pocket. If you can decommodify those things, you're making life more affordable. Even if you're not making more money, suddenly things are more affordable. So that's the path to go down in the next little while, I think.
Armin Yalnızyan, always appreciate the perspective. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
A new report released in March takes a snapshot of Canada's economy, and the picture, it's bleak. Among the findings, the economy not only stalled in 2023, it contracted on a per capita basis. And the GDP per capita fell faster than at any time in at least six decades. The authors found the growth in Canada's clean technology a disturbing development. And Canada's business R&D hovered at about 0.6% of the GDP last year, which they say is little change from 2022. Former Conservative Cabinet Minister Lisa Raitt and former Liberal Cabinet Minister Anne McClellan co-chair of the Coalition for a Better Future, and they join me now. It's good to see you both again. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, great
David.
To see you.
So, Lisa, you flagged concerns last year for more urgency in decisions by policymakers, and this year the report says those worries are even heightened, more heightened. Why? What's happening?
There. Well, I think what you're seeing is that we still don't have the fundamental basics in place to talk about long-term economic growth that's actually working. So we take a look at these 21 KPIs, these metrics, on an annual basis. We've been doing this since 2021 is when we started the endeavor. And we had hoped that we would see tracking going up. And we're actually a lot surprised that we're seeing tracking going in the wrong direction, given that other countries are tracking up in areas in which we should be doing better. So for us, that means that there's a problem. But it's not for us to suggest what the solution is. What we say then is, look, policymakers, here's the evidence as to why this isn't working. You really should go and take a second look at what your policies are. But there is one policy we agree on that does have to be dealt with, and that is the regulatory regime.
Right.
And that will help people invest in Canada because it's the number one impediment to getting more business investment here.
Okay, so KPI, key performance indicators,
correct,
right? You say they're tracking,
yes,
in the wrong direction. So, Anne, when you look at that data, what concerns you the most in terms of where we're going in the wrong direction?
Well, I think what concerns me, and should concern everyone, is that relative to the people to whom we compare ourselves, the countries around the world, we are going in the wrong direction. So, for example, our gross domestic product per capita, yes, small increase this year, which is okay. But in comparison to, say, the United States per capita, that gap is widening. I think it's something like $15,000 now. If you look at productivity per worker, productivity in the United States is, I think, something like 3.5 times higher than that which you see in Canada per worker. That tells you that you're not seeing the economic productivity that you need to ensure ongoing prosperity for all Canadians.
So why is that? I mean, when you GDP per capita, is that because there's more people retiring, boomers, populations getting older? What accounts for
when
that
gap?
When
you work back from productivity and GDP, there are lots of different factors, some of which you have identified. But if you look at what drives GDP, productivity, it is private sector investment in machines and equipment. It's too low. It's private sector investment in intellectual property. It is private sector investment in adult education, on-the-job learning. We trail so many other countries in terms of the on-the-job adult education that you see other countries providing so that their individual workers are more efficient. They're producing more per hour, not less.
Yeah. Okay, so at least I heard Anne say private sector investment a bunch of times. So is this a call to action for the private sector, or is this a policy solution that the government needs to enact to force the private sector or encourage the private sector?
Answer is yes.
Okay, all of it. Yeah.
Okay, it's all of it. So business will say to you, the reason why we're not doing more in R&D is because of having to make the case for investment in Canada, because a lot of times these are big multinational corporations. We just don't have a guarantee on how long it's going to take for our project. We're not getting as much return on it. And that's a policy fix in a lot of ways.
Right.
But we also need to have the companies be aware of the fact that Canada is worthy of the investment. And complacency is not something that we should actually be encouraging as time goes by, because it's going to have a major impact on the long-term future of this country.
Do you think the private sector in this country is too complacent on investment? I've heard this criticism over the years that they'd rather send money out to shareholders and juice dividends rather than reinvest in productivity and expansion or whatever. Yeah, what's your sense?
It's not what I think. It's what I see in the data. And if you take a look at how we compare to R&D in the United States, in Japan, in the UK, it is starkly different, like 3.5 times lower than Japan, significantly different than in the UK and in the United States. So I don't need to have a feeling about whether Canadian companies are doing it. I see the metric that Canadian companies are not investing in R&D like the rest of the world is. And that does have an impact on GDP per capita. That has an impact on what we can actually purchase in our country.
Okay, so Anne, Lisa mentioned things like the regulatory regime needs to change. I know major projects, especially if you're going to do critical minerals and these things, people want it to move fast. Is that one thing that encourages this, speeds it up? What are the other things they could look at as a government?
Well, first of all, that I think is the number one thing people need to look at, right? Wherever you go in the world where you're seeking foreign investment into Canada, the question people ask is, well, can you get anything built, right? That's a pretty scary question, David. And investors expect a return on their investment. So regulatory reform absolutely is key to our ability to get projects up and running in a timely fashion. I think other things in terms of the economy, just overall, talking about the private sector and helping Canadians understand that making a profit and being successful and being a Canadian champion is a good thing.
It's a good thing.
We should be talking about it. We should be proud of our private sector. And we don't seem to see that conversation a lot in this country.
That is not the political conversation now. It's all about gouging grocery stores and big telecoms and banks and windfall. I mean, but there's a reason people are feeling that way about corporate Canada, right?
Well, yes, there is. But the reason is largely beyond the control of any one government, right? Inflation is a global factor. The war in Ukraine, the war in the Middle East, those are global factors that have led to, in large part, the affordability crisis, right? Global supply chains disrupted. All of it drives inflation up, causes the banks, central banks, to move in and increase interest rates. Actually, that is beyond the control of any one government. Then you have to talk about how do you protect your citizens and your private sector against those events. And you've seen the government try and do that through a number of programs. I think we can talk about how effective some of them have been. But it seems to me that, yes, the conversation is, oh, companies are making too much money, making too many profits. But in fact, if you look at other countries, countries are proud of their global leaders. They talk about them. Young people want to go and work there. And somehow we've lost that conversation. We used to have that conversation. I remember my former boss, Mr. Kretchen. How proud was he of the CANDU reactor as a technology and talking about it around the world? Well, people seem to have lost that desire to talk about the things we're good at.
Well, wedge politics maybe plays a role in this and simplistic reduction of complex issues, to create attack points. And it changes the understanding and the conversation of the challenge. But, Lisa, one of the things the government has tried to do is encourage investment into clean tech and the transition.
Right.
And you're sounding an alarm here that it's really been stalled, investment in clean tech.
Thank you for bringing it up, because that is a really big concern. That can be fixed. It's been over 500 days since ITCs, income tax credits, were actually promised. They're still not been proclaimed yet. They're not in place, and companies are just waiting for it. The United States, however, they're way far down the road, and they're attracting the industries and the innovation. And, in terms of the bigger problem in all of this, the bigger problem is, I'm so glad you mentioned, Anne, about pride. We've got a generation out there who want to work in Canada are having a difficult time finding a job, but they're losing faith in actually what it is that Canada can do for them. And we had a Nick Nanos survey that we commissioned. Mm-hmm. And he took a look. He took a look at, you know, whether or not we're going in the right direction when it comes to increasing Canadian standard of living, and the result was stunning. And he was actually surprised by it, because one would think that youth is optimistic, and the older we get, we're not as optimistic, and it's completely the reversal. Yeah. If you ask this to 18 to 34 year olds, 63.6% of them say that we're going in the wrong direction when it comes to increasing high standard of living. How do you keep those kids in Canada and not be attracted to cheaper houses and better jobs in the United States if we don't get our act together here?
It's a challenge for the rich Western countries that each generation did better than mm-hmm. the generation before, because we could build up from low bases. And we've gotten to a point where the base is so high, when you get population shifts and cost shifts like mm-hmm. you outlined, I'm not surprised 18 to 34-year-olds are pessimistic when you look at where wages are, where mm-hmm. job security is, where pensions are, and where the ability to buy a house
is. Yeah.
And that seems to be the number one thing potentially driving.
And this year we took a look at housing, although you're the expert in the housing, because another cross-partisan panel Lisa was involved in came up with
I think we talked about that on this show. 140
recommendations
we did.
In relation to housing. But you're right. And it's not only for young people about owning a house. We met with 80 students yesterday, David, at the Telfer School of Management at the University of Ottawa. Mm-hmm. Those are young people. They're not looking at buying a house at this stage. They are trying to figure out how they pay the rent for an apartment. They're sharing with two or three other people, and they are working 40 hours a week in some cases, as well as going to school, and they still may have to access the food bank at the University of Ottawa. So I think it's not surprising that Nick's numbers show that that generation, at least a certain chunk of that generation, are feeling very pessimistic, and rightly so, about what their future might hold for them.
So when you look at all of this, we've got a federal budget coming up April 16th.
Yeah.
If there's one thing you'd like to see from Chrystia Freeland, I know the tax credits or something, they promised retroactivity on that, but we don't yet know when the precision and the clarity will come. What's the one thing you'd like to see from the finance minister in this budget?
So, I mean, I just want to see something that's going to start moving economic development. For me personally, it's Indigenous equity loan guarantees.
Yep. Which they promised in the fall economic statement. I think we'd see some clarity on that.
I feel very comfortable that it's going to happen, and I think that's a really good first step in getting things done.
What about you, Anne? Just what would be one thing from you?
I think it was two budgets ago they promised to look at regulatory reform and look at the current system, look for efficiencies, and make it more effective. I would love to see some concrete direction, something that goes beyond nice words and tells the private sector that this is the regime that we will have to meet in developing our project, whatever it is.
A specific.
Yes.
David, if I could, just one last thing. Anne and I started this endeavor in 2021, and at the time we said, we have to act now to have a long-term growth plan because we can't afford to wait for a crisis. What the Nick Nanos survey tells us is our kids between 18 and 34, they are in a crisis. That's why it's fragile. That's why we need to act now.
Okay. All right. We're going to end it there. Lisa Raitt, Anne McClellan, co-chairs of the Coalition for a Better Future. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
The federal government releases its annual budget on April 16th. There is a lot of pressure on the government to announce more help for Canadians struggling with the cost of living. But is there any fiscal room to do that? Kevin Page is the president of the Institute of Fiscal Studies and Democracy at the University of Ottawa, and he joins me now. Kevin Page, always good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Good to be with you.
You've assessed the country's finances as not great, not bad. What does that mean for the public expectations going into this budget, do you think?
Yeah, it means we've taken on a lot of debt because of COVID and all those fiscal supports during COVID, so we've lost a lot of fiscal room. You know, those debt numbers, debt to GDP numbers, even the deficit is elevated right now. So that's the not so good part. I mean, the better part, I think, is the fact that still our numbers, and we hear this from the Deputy Prime Minister, the Finance Minister Freeland, that like we're still way better off on a relative basis. You know, our debt numbers, our budget balance numbers are way better than the U.S., way better than the EU.
So when people talk about the situation we're in, maybe in terms of it being on the verge of a crisis, how should we view that? Because we've heard business groups saying they need to cut spending, the debt servicing is getting too high, we've got to invest in productivity. The conservatives are saying, you know, that they're going to fix this budget. How should we assess how precarious the finances are compared?
Yeah, there's absolutely no crisis in terms of like a public finance crisis. I think, you know, all those numbers that, you know, that people allude to, it's elevated debt. I think if you look at the budgetary balance, we're talking about something around $40 billion in terms of a deficit, a percentage of GDP about 1.5. If you go back to the 80s, we ran deficits at 5-6 percentage points of GDP, not 1.5%. If you compare us with the United States, they're at 6.5% as a percentage of GDP. That would be like $170 billion in Canada. Mm. So I think, I don't think the deficit is out of whack. The interest costs are, again, they're about a little over 1%. You know, through the 80s, they were at 5-6 percentage points of GDP. So we're still near record lows on interest as a percentage of GDP. So I think in terms of, again, we're AAA in terms of investment grade bonds and bills. So where's the crisis?
So on that, I mean, they are facing a bit of a political crisis. I think it's fair to say that when you look at where they are in terms of public opinion, this current government. And they've made some promises to deliver on things, but also made some promises to sort of move to this fiscal anchor and keeping, you know, deficits to about 1% of GDP going forward and rein it in. Can they do that and deliver on things like pharmacare, move on housing? And we've seen the childcare program kind of having a failure to launch at the scale they were hoping, all of which might require more government money. Can they deliver on these things and keep that level of discipline they're promising?
Well, I think they can't deficit finance, you know, large new structural programs, including pharmacare programs. They're going to have to find offsets. So if this budget is important strategically for them, I think they're going to have to find some fiscal room between now and the next election. I think to the critics' point is, you know, the Liberals have increased spending significantly. In nominal dollar terms, as a percentage of GDP, about two full percentage points. That's like $60 billion higher as, you know, program spending relative to GDP. So that's a lot of spending.
Right.
And there hasn't been a lot of constraint so far. So, yeah, I think we'll have to wait and see.
So how do they do that now, do that constraint at this stage in the life cycle of a government with an election 18 months away? I mean, you said find fiscal room. So that means cuts somewhere, right? Or tax hikes somewhere. How do they do that with the time they have in a way that is palatable and viable?
Yeah, I heard a U.S. commentator talk about the U.S. Democrats being good at addition but not subtraction. I think you could use the same reference to the Liberals. They're good at addition but not subtraction. I think how do they do that? They have to cut spending. And if you can, arithmetically, you can look at spending. They've grown the base of spending significantly, including just, you know, operation costs. You know, and so there's opportunities to find savings. They're going to have to cut to find room to finance new programs.
But where are the areas where you think they could do that? Like, is there a soft spot in the size of the state, where they could start cutting things back?
Operations. Yeah, it's very swollen. If you look at, when they came into office, you look at the size of the wage bill or non-wage operating spending, and you look at the growth of government. I think it's grown significantly. There's significant savings there in the billions of dollars, and I think that's one area they're going to have to find. Unfortunately, they've kind of already booked it. You know, if you look at the fiscal planning framework, they're trying to hold that kind of spending constant. But it's still constant at a very high level.
So when you talk about operations, you talk about the size of the civil service, reducing the number of jobs in the civil service.
Yeah.
Any specific areas that you get? Because people would say, look, you need this for the service delivery, or you need this, to manage these programs. You need this to do whatever it is, the good things that government does. Where are the areas where you think they could target?
I think it's across the board. I think in this case, normally, having been a public servant for many years, when you hear politicians talk about across-the-board cuts, we don't like it.
Right.
But I think if you look at the growth, the growth is pretty, since 2015 by the Liberal government, it's been across the board.
There's about there's two budgets left potentially between the next election and who knows how a handful of interest rate decision points for the Bank of Canada. How much do you think what Tiff Macklem
and the board of governors there may do an interest rate weighs into the decision-making process right now. How does Chrystia Freeland factor that into the decision she's making for the budget?
Well, I think in terms of the economy, in terms of short term, I think the Bank of Canada is the game changer. We need to get these interest rates down. There's an enormous amount of debt in the Canadian economy. Even on a relative basis, when we compare our economy with other economies, we're carrying a lot of debt at the household level relative to disposable income. If you look at like mortgage interest debt, we've never been this high before as a percentage of disposable income. So these, having 5-year conventional mortgage interest rates at 6.5%, this is really going to hurt a lot of families as we move into 2024. So it's the game changer. We need to get interest rates down, I think, to maintain a soft landing, I think, at this point. Mm. I think Minister Freeland is counting on this being probably a difficult year economically, slow growth, high interest rates, but a reduction of interest rates and then growth picking up in 2025 and then maybe a better electoral prospects.
So obviously she can't control, Chrystia Freeland cannot control what the governor of the Bank of Canada does. So what does she need to do in terms of reining in the spending, anticipating there's going to be cuts in interest rates at some point this year? I mean, what's at risk for the government, for the economy, if they don't bring in this level of fiscal discipline that everyone is suggesting that they need?
Yeah, I think it's trust and credibility in terms of managing public finances. And I think Minister Freeland's added targets, for 2024-25, trying to keep the deficit at $40 billion, as you've already alluded to in the outer years, to get the deficit at 1% or low as a percentage of GDP. She has to hit those targets. Otherwise, I think she'll lose credibility and trust.
Because they haven't really hit a target yet. I mean, there's reasons for that. The pandemic is a good reason. But there have been, outside of those years even, they've never sort of hit sort of modest deficits that were sort of the center of the 2015 campaign. And I just wonder, you talked about the AAA credit rating. Does hitting your targets factor into those assessments by
Yes.
the bond rating agencies, or is it just the bottom line measurables?
No, it's all of the above, I think. So, yes, they ran deficits higher than, say, $10 billion that they promised to in the post-2015 era. COVID completely changed mm-hmm. the environment. I think if you look at the size of the deficit during COVID as a percentage of the economy and look at where we're at right now, nobody's brought the deficit down faster than Canada and sort of the G8 countries. So they've really unwound those supports. At a deficit at a little over 1%, 1 to 1.5 percentage points of GDP, it's like not a problem right now. But again, then the question is, what about the next shock, which we've heard from a lot of critics? And they're right. Like, we'd be, if we had a geopolitical crisis, another economic shock, a health shock, would we have the largesse, the support, the economy in the way we did in the last two crises? And I think the answer is we have less room.
But just as a final point, when you hear the criticism of the state of the finances and where the debt is and where the deficit is, when you look abroad, when you look globally, you actually believe this country's in a pretty good position at the national government level. Is that fair to say?
Abroad, when you look in a relative, when you look at, you compare Canada versus, say, the OECD countries, but also historically, even in the Canadian context, having kind of been in the Department of Finance in the 80s and 90s, these numbers are not, we're nowhere near fiscal crisis numbers. I mean, whether you look at debt or whether you look at deficits, or it's the cost of public interest charges.
Kevin Page, president of the Institute of Fiscal Studies and Democracy at the University of Ottawa. Thanks for your time, as always.
Good to be with you.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochran. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.